All right. Good evening. Are you guys leftists or rightists? Well, it's good to see you. Good evening. Tonight we're going to get into three major arguments for the existence of God. Next week and the following will be our last two sessions together. I just thought I would remind you that next week we're going to do the doctrine of the Trinity, dealing with questions like, can anyone really understand Trinitarianism? And if so, how? Defending the triune Godhead, defending Trinitarianism, and then defeating false gods, which I think will be a lot of fun. And then the last session will be the real Jesus, historicity. I changed it because we were throwing around historical Jesus the other day. I thought I better change that. The historicity, nature, and existence of Jesus. And then getting into subjects like hypostasis, the hypostatic union. How is he God and man? How does that work? Refuting false resurrection hypotheses. That's always fun. There are some really odd ones out there. And then getting into credible, non-biblical or extra-biblical historical accounts of Jesus. The only thing I would mention is I might reverse these last two. There's a lot more work on the Trinity that I need to do, so I might flip-flop those. Maybe not. But anyway, those are the last two sessions. So I think we've got last week is the notes, and the audio is now up on the website. So if anybody needs that, it's there. If you don't have the link, let us know, and we can get you the link. All right, so I want to start with, because we're going to make three arguments, and that's really the gist of tonight's discussion, I wanted to start with spending a couple of minutes on argumentation, on making arguments. Excuse me. Formulating an argument. If you're trying to help someone understand any of these points we've discussed, or you know, any particular theological issue, or any other issue for that matter, if you don't want your spouse to catch you in a bad argument, you better study up on how to make a good argument, right? So there are a lot of things that go into making bad arguments. I'm not going to go through all those examples. I did create for you an appendix to tonight's notes with 30 of the most used errors in argumentation, and with their common titles and descriptions. So what I really want to focus on tonight in this area is simply validity and soundness. So I've got three examples of arguments I want to make, and we're going to just kind of use these as our basis for discussion. So an argument, of course, is based on a premise, which must actually be true, of course, an observation, or second premise sometimes, which cannot be denied. These are important points. And then a conclusion which logically follows from the premise and the observation, or second premise. And here's an example. Fish can breathe in water. Cats drown in water if you hold them down long enough. And cats are not fish. That's a fairly decent argument. We want to first check and see if our premise and observation are true. Is it true that fish can breathe in water? Yeah, that's true. Now, they have gills to do that. And then the observation is that cats drown in water if you hold them down long enough, and maybe if you have some leather gloves up to here and you know make a few other precautions, they will drown in water. Sorry, cat lovers. But you can logically deduce from those true premises the conclusion that cats are not fish. If cats were fish, they could breathe in water and you couldn't drown one by holding it down. So this argument is both sound and valid. It's sound because the premises are true. If you have either of your premises, if your premises, your premise or your observation, if either of those are false, then you have an argument that is unsound. Both of the premises have to be true. If the conclusion does not follow from the two premises, then your argument is invalid. Have you ever made an argument and somebody said, well, that's invalid? Well, now you can demonstrate whether or not it actually was invalid or whether someone else's is valid or invalid, because it really comes down to, are the premises true and does the conclusion logically follow? That's pretty basic, you know, logic course 101. So the validity of an argument is key, because when we're discussing these things with skeptics and atheists or people who have honest questions, we will often face poor argumentation from their side. You're going to get arguments that don't even make any sense. They're so obviously invalid or obviously unsound. But you don't want to laugh. You just want to merely break that down and expose the errors. So an argument is only valid if its conclusion logically flows from the premise and the observation. And an argument is sound only if its premise and observations are true. Straightforward enough? All right. I've got a couple of other examples in the notes for you of what an invalid argument looks like and an unsound argument, but just recognizing that an invalid argument has a conclusion problem. It has the conclusion is not flowing from the two premises. And soundness regards premises, one or both being false. Now, it is possible to have a true premise, a true observation, and a true conclusion, and still have a problem with the argument, because it may be the case that the conclusion, while true, doesn't necessarily flow from the two premises. Does that make sense? So you have to be careful. You can't just say, well, if this is true, and this is true, and this is true, my argument stands. Because it may not. It may be the case that while the two premises are true, the true conclusion doesn't logically follow from the two premises. And then last point on this, then we'll move on. You do want to be careful not to readily accept a premise. This is where we normally get in trouble when people are making false arguments. Is they give you a premise, which in your mind you're thinking, I think that's questionable. Then you give you another premise, and maybe that one's even worse. And then they give you a conclusion which logically flows from the two premises. And now you're not sure where to go from there. And the key is you got to go back and examine each one of those premises and make sure they're true. Validity and soundness. All right. How would you answer somebody, you don't have to answer this today, but getting the question in our minds is, how would you answer someone who said there's no God? I don't believe there's a God. Or flatly, there is no God. Or I'm not sure if there's a God, or how can I logically conceive of God? I've never had any experience with God. How do I deal with that? There are, 15 or 18 arguments out there today. Actually, my doctoral thesis, I'm hoping to add another to that battery. But there are three that are really popular, really easy to understand, really easy to present, and really easy to defend. And so those are the three that we're going to examine tonight. So the first one is the teleological argument. And T-E-L-O, telos in Greek means goal or objective. This is the argument that's also sometimes known as the intelligent design argument. The background of the argument is it was first formulated in the 5th century BC by Socrates, of all people. We know what a great philosopher Socrates was, but then it was advanced by Cicero, if you know who that is, in the 1st century BC. Thomas Aquinas added a few twists to it in Summa Theologica in the 13th century. But then William Paley, a 19th century theologian, in his work Natural Theology, gave an example, which we're going to look at in a minute. It's known as Paley's Watchmaker Argument. The Apostle Paul wrote that there is not only obvious evidence of God having created the universe, but the evidence, as we've said, I think almost in every session, is reasonably sufficient to warrant logical belief in God. Romans 1:20. For since the creation of the world, his, that is God's, invisible attributes, that is his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived. Not just seen, but clearly perceived, being understood by what has been made, so that they are without excuse, those who deny the existence of God or suppress the knowledge of God. So that's a little bit of background. Let's look at Paley's Watchmaker Argument. Now, I did paraphrase this because the argument's quite a bit longer. This is my Noel's paraphrase, so don't take this as a word for word. It's mostly Paley's words, but I tried to condense it down for a 21st century audience. His argument basically is that a watch like you wear on your wrist, bears evidence of design just by examining it with no other information or conversation or enlightenment, just examining it, that it bears evidence of design and thus implies that it was created by a designer, a watchmaker. So here it goes. He says, suppose I stumbled upon a stone that happened to be lying on the ground, and I were asked how it came to be there. Well, I might reply that for all I knew, it had been there forever. And it would be difficult for anyone to demonstrate absurdity in my explanation. However, suppose I came upon a watch on the ground, and I were asked how the watch came to be there. I would not have been able to give the same reply I offered concerning the stone. The evidence of design in the watch shows it had an original purpose. And if a purpose, a designer who created it for its purpose. Now, compared to nature, the watch is not nearly as complex. Thus, nature's creator must be greater than the creator of the watch. That makes sense? Pretty straightforward argument. The basic idea is that the universe bears evidence of design, and if design, designer, and if a designer, purpose. There's also the issue of fine-tuning, something we call the anthropic principle. And briefly stated, the universe seems to be fine-tuned so as to support carbon-based life forms, such as us, and plants, other animals. I'm going to give you three examples of fine-tuning, but if you took some time to study this and go online, you could probably find 30 or 40 different factors that if they were to vary just very slightly in the way the universe was designed, laws of physics and so forth, that the universe could not continue to exist. So here's the first one. If the strength of the Big Bang explosion had varied by as little as one part in 10 to the 60th power, that's 60 zeros after it, just one in 10 to the 60th power parts, the universe would either have collapsed on itself or expanded too quickly for stars to form. And of course, with no stars, life could not have been possible in either of those circumstances. If the strong nuclear force that binds together the protons and neutrons of an atom had been either stronger or weaker by just 5%, an atom would not hold together and life would not be possible. And then here's the third one. If gravity, which is what holds us to the Earth, you know, the mass and density of the Earth. If gravity had been stronger or weaker by one part in 10 to the 40th power, one in 10 plus 40 zeros, stars like the sun could not have formed, and again, life could not have been possible. If those baffle you, the other 27 that I'm aware of would baffle you just as much. But the basic idea is that the way the universe was designed to sustain it and to afford the opportunity for life. Now, I know there are lots of folks that believe there are life on other planets. I don't really believe that there are. Maybe there are. I don't know. But it is a unique thing to consider that the universe, had it varied in all of its physics, by just the slightest amounts in any one of probably thousands and thousands of ways, the universe couldn't be in existence today, or if it was, it certainly couldn't support carbon-based life forms. So that's known as the anthropic principle. Now, in recent decades, secular science has come up with something they call the multiverse explanation for this. They argue that the universe only appears to be fine-tuned, since only in a universe capable of sustaining human life could such apparent fine-tuning phenomena be observed. They suggest that the universe that we're in is only one of many, multiverse, one of many, and thus random and not designed by any uncaused cause, which would get us into the cosmological argument in a minute, that God is the uncaused cause of the universe. So in other words, there were so many millions or trillions of universes that currently exist. It just happens that the one that we live in, we're looking at it backwards. It sustains life because it's the one that randomly was able to do that, while all the other trillions and gazillions of others weren't able to, presumably. Just keep in mind that multiverse is a theory. Okay, it's not a scientific fact. It's just a theory. It's just an idea. It's a way, as with evolutionary theory, it's a way to explain away creationism with an idea. You always want to keep that in mind when you've got anything with the word theory attached to it that stands against the knowledge of God. So I do think it's a little bit ironic that scientists argue for a multiverse, which exists only in theory and has never been proven, but they reject a creator God, which on their methodology is no less an unproven theory, yet a much more plausible explanation. It has we call explanatory power that the multiverse theory lacks grossly. Modern science appears to have, something Pastor and I were kicking around a while back, we maybe even thought about doing a session, maybe one day we will, on anti-supernaturalism. Modern science today has an anti-supernaturalist bias. So in other words, they come to the knowledge of anything with a bias, a presupposition that says there is nothing outside the physical world. There is no supernatural realm of existence of any kind. And so if you come to the table for discussion and your mind is already closed to supernatural reality, then you are forced to come up with crazy ideas like multiverse theory. Does that make sense? You're forced into that. We're not doing evolution in this series, but my favorite argument against evolutionary theory, Darwinian evolutionary theory, is that there are no transitional life forms in the fossil record. Well, this was a problem for the first several decades after the Origin of Life was published. And they couldn't come up with any explanation. Modern science, who fairly quickly adopted evolutionary theory, couldn't come up with an explanation for the fact that there are not even a single one, transitionary life forms in the fossil record. All you find are complete species, no transitions. So they came up with something called punctuated equilibrium. Again, it's just an idea. It's the idea that in the evolutionary process, at certain times, species evolve at a supersonic rapid rate such that it appears that they were all created out of nothing at the same time, rather than the reality in their view that these things evolved only just extremely quickly in a short span of time. So again, this anti-supernaturalist view forces science into these, I think, wild and crazy ideas. So let's look at the teleological argument. The argument reasons that since there is evidence of purpose in the universe, an agent of purpose is implied. Or say it another way, since there is evidence of design in the universe, a designer is implied. And this is how the argument is often formulated. So here it goes. Remember, premise, observation, conclusion, right? Premise, observation, conclusion. Or premise, conclusion. Here we go. In the universe, there are observable phenomena of complex systems with precise tuning that bear evidence of purposeful design. Is that true? Can we say yes? Yes, that's true. Right? Everybody seen a solar system? Or a galaxy? Okay. Evidence, here's our observation, evidence of purposeful design in the universe implies the existence of a purposeful designer with the attributes necessary to create the universe. That's an observation. It's a true observation. There is evidence of purposeful design. That implies the existence of a purposeful designer. You can't have design without a designer, right? If you saw my first apartment, you would agree with that. Thank you, Tony. I needed somebody to chuckle at that. That was a bad one. That was a dad joke. Sorry, Noah. So the best explanation of these phenomena is the existence of a designer God. So to just say it really simply, the universe bears evidence of design, right? We can see it all around us. Look at a cell. Look at a human body. Look at the water systems around the world, and so on. So the universe bears evidence of design. This implies a designer with the attributes necessary to design, to create. And the best explanation, the conclusion is, the best explanation is a creator God. Now, we haven't argued for the God of the Bible, and this argument doesn't go there. The teleological argument doesn't take us there. But it does get us to the point of, if there is evidence of design outside of humanity, yeah, we can design things. But is there evidence of design in the universe, in the cosmos, in the world? And if that's the case, then that implies a designer with attributes capable of creating, and then the best explanation is a creator God. We got that one? Amen? Yeah? Really? Show of hands if you feel like you fairly understand that one. Okay, if one of the spouses went up, I'll go that she or he will teach the other later. Okay. All right, so let's move on. That's an easy one. I think that's pretty easy. The universe has evidence of design. It implies a designer. If it implies a designer, then the best argument, the best solution, the best conclusion is a creator God. All right, this one's going to be a little bit longer, I think. Let's talk about Big Bang cosmology. I won't take a poll, but there are a lot of Christians today that have a problem with the Big Bang. I'm not sure why. It seems perfectly biblical to me and to many Christian apologists today. But the argument we're going to get into is what we call the cosmological argument. It's the argument that answers the question, why does anything exist at all? You know, why does anything exist? Why do I exist? Why does the planet exist? Why does the sun exist? Why do lamps exist? Why does anything at all exist? This argument was first formulated, if you can believe it, in the 4th century BC by Plato and Aristotle, who, you know, basically descended, if you will, intellectually, philosophically, from Socrates. 4th century BC, it's been refined through the ages, but the argument version we're going to look at tonight is the Kalam, K-A-L-A-M. I think it's probably the simplest and easiest to communicate, the Kalam cosmological argument. It first arose in the 9th century. It's an Arabic philosophical argument for God's existence. 3 centuries into Islam is when Islam produced this argument. The guy's name was Al-Kindi, wrote a book called On First Philosophy. That's it if you care. It'll be in the notes. Dr. William Lane Craig, anybody ever heard of him? One of my professors at seminary, yep. He's, despite his thoughts in the last few months or years, a couple of years, is probably one of the most brilliant people to ever attempt Christian apologetics in the history of man. He's written probably 60 books. His brain is fascinating. He refined the Kalam, a cosmological argument, in the way we're going to look at it here in just a minute. But the argument deals with the question, as I said, why does anything exist at all? Why is there something rather than nothing? How did the universe get here? How did it get here? Did it always exist, or did it have a beginning? And if so, if it had a beginning, what caused it to exist? Now, I promise you, you can understand and communicate this. I taught this to first graders, I think last year at my daughter's school where she teaches Latin. And the kids got it. They were able to grasp it. So I'm confident that we can too. So, science is largely unified in the belief that the universe began to exist at the Big Bang. And the Big Bang is the moment at which all matter was originally, believed to be originally located at a single point. So all the matter of the universe was condensed down into a single point, in a single locus, a single place, occupying the space that would be required for all the material in the universe to occupy. And then it exploded with an infusion of power, producing intense heat, expanded to create the known universe, and then it began to cool over time. That's the Big Bang theory. Since the universe appears to be expanding and cooling, the cosmological modeling shows that if you trace the universe backward in time, matter gets closer together and it gets hotter. And if you continue to trace it back in time, you eventually arrive at a point at which all matter was in a single location. Does that make sense? Has anybody ever read A Brief History of Time? A few people? Okay, yeah. I think that's reading for everybody in the room if you really care about the subject. The book's probably, 80 pages? It's not very long. It's a bit thick in places. Who's the guy who wrote that? Do I have that in my notes? I can't think of his name right now. There's a movie about him, Theory of Everything. He was a Cambridge student, I believe, who dropped out of school when he came up with this idea, the basic concept being that the universe is expanding. If it's expanding, it was closer together yesterday. It was even closer together the day before. And if you keep going back in history, the universe and all of its matter is in one spot. Something caused that to expand. It would have been an infusion of power, an explosion of massive proportions. So modern science believes that this occurred around 13.8 billion years ago, that at that point matter was assembled at a single point. And I would like to read for you, I meant to stick it in my notes, but let me just read for you the first couple of verses of Genesis. And just see if we can imagine this concept represented in the text. Here we go. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was formless. You ever wondered about that? How could the earth, which has a form, right? It's a sphere, be formless? How could it not have a form? Or perhaps the case is that it was a part of the large mass of all matter that was in one single place at the beginning. You see that concept, at least? So the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. Best way this could be described, apparently, by Moses. But no light, obviously, darkness. And the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters, this material, whatever it is. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. You see it? You have a formless, shapeless earth. You have the Holy Spirit moving over it. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. That is consistent with the Big Bang theory. It's not inconsistent. I want to take a little bit of a left turn, a little bit of a sidetrack. On this 13.8 billion years business. The age of the universe at 13.8 billion doesn't take into account some recent discoveries in the measurement of the speed of light. Now, the engineers in the room, if they're not aware of this, their toes might curl. Be happy to talk about it after we have our time together. But I first heard about this, I read an article about this in a journal in 1998. Steffi and I were on our way to Great Britain to celebrate our 10th anniversary, and a good friend of mine whose father was an engineer and I were having this discussion. I told him I had just read this article, and he says, no, it's not possible, that the speed of light can't be changing, it's got to be constant, that's a foundational law of physics. So, well, I did read it in this article, and apparently there were measurements in the late 1800s, and as they've gone through the last century or so, there have been a few other measurements, and there does seem to be some slight degradation in the speed of light. 2 weeks later, on our return flight, that was on the flight over to London, to Heathrow, on the return flight, the flight attendant was going around handing out newspapers, and I asked for London Times. So she handed me the London Times, and above the fold, on the front page, speed of light slowing down. Well, I got up and ran and found Mike and threw that in his lap, and I said, hey, if the London Times printed it, it must be true. So I don't know if it's true, but I offer that there is some discussion out there now today about it. We also have now been able to challenge the notion that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, right? Well, it's actually nothing that has mass can travel faster than the speed of light. There are other things that travel faster than the speed of light. I won't get into those things, but I just want to kind of get your curiosity going about that idea. But consider this. If the speed of light is slowing down, that could account for a much younger age of the universe, depending upon how rapidly it slowed down, whether or not it has slowed down at an even rate, or whether or not it slowed down quickly at first, and then at maybe perhaps right after the creation event, and then found what's very close to a constant. Now, we don't know. Obviously, nobody was there that's here. We don't know, but if the speed of light is slowing down, it would likely be due to what we call entropy. And I think I mentioned this a couple of times before. Entropy is what we call the second law of thermodynamics. And it states that if any system is left to itself, it will go on to randomness or disorder. That's one way of looking at it. So the idea is that everything in the universe is decaying. It's winding down. It's slowing down. It's wearing out. Things tend to move from order to chaos. Clean out a closet. Come back in 3 months. Entropy. Right? It's gone from order to chaos. Here's a couple of verses of scripture. There are others. Here's two good ones. Psalm 102, 25 and 26. Of old you founded the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. Even they will perish, but you endure, and all of them will wear out like a garment. The work of your hands will wear out like a garment. Like clothing, you will change them, and they will be changed. Might be a reference to the new heaven and new earth. That's Psalm 102. Here's Romans 8. 19 through 22, for the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope, and here it comes, that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. The whole creation, all of the universe, wearing out, winding down, subject to corruption, falling apart. So it seems that entropy may regard even the laws of physics, it seems, or at least this one, speed of light, which heretofore have been deemed constants in the universe. So this is also a problem, I think, for Darwinian evolutionary theory, which I mentioned earlier, which argues the opposite of the entropy laws. Evolutionary theory argues that the universe goes from chaos to order. So in other words, you have chaos, and then it somehow it finds order in itself and then produces more and more complexity as it advances in order, rather than the other way around, going from order to chaos, breaking down, falling apart, and wearing out. So back to the Big Bang Theory and Big Bang cosmology and this argument we're trying to make. The explosion of this matter produced light, of course, and heat in the universe. The biblical account, as I just read, seems to be consistent, certainly isn't inconsistent with the Big Bang Theory. And then finally, the word cosmos, as in cosmological, it means order. It is the word from which we get cosmetics, which is designed to bring order out of chaos. Couldn't pass that one up. Pastor, you can steal that if you like. He told me to. So here's the argument. So let's get into the argument. The Kalam version of the cosmological argument argues that the universe began to exist and that something uncaused caused it to come into existence. It uses deductive reasoning, which we've laid out at the very beginning, in which a conclusion is deduced from the combination of a major and a minor premise, or a major premise and an observation. So it's presented in two logical steps. So to make this argument, it's two steps. And I'm telling you, these first graders got it. They were able to help me and do it. These steps, we call these syllogisms, if you want a fancy word, impress your friends. It works like this. Step one, syllogism one. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Is that true? Yes, no, maybe? That's true. Of course it's true. I mean, logic shows us that. History shows that. Experience shows us that. If something begins to exist, it has a cause. The universe began to exist. Science certainly agrees with that point. That's what the Big Bang argument's all about. You see why that's important not to reject, if you want to make this argument. So, step one, everything that begins to exist has a cause. That's a premise. The universe began to exist. That's an observation. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Do you see how we got there? It's pretty simple, right? Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. The universe has a cause. Now, syllogism number two. Step two. The universe has a cause. We've established that. The cause of the universe must itself be uncaused. With me? Yeah? The cause of the universe must be uncaused. Therefore, an uncaused cause of the universe exists. Once more. The universe has a cause. The cause of the universe must itself be uncaused. Therefore, an uncaused cause of the universe exists. You can do a third one. And the third one takes you... So we've gone from the universe having a cause to the universe having an uncaused cause. And the uncaused cause, you can make another set of arguments, that uncaused cause has to have certain attributes, or it wouldn't be able to cause anything to come into existence. You with me there? All right, here's a list of some of those. The uncaused cause of the universe must be personal. It must be a person, because impersonal things don't create. Right? Have you ever seen a stapler create anything? You know, or a chair? They don't create, right? They're inanimate. So it must be personal. An uncaused cause must be beginningless. That's not the same as uncaused. It means there's no beginning. Otherwise, it would require a cause if it had a beginning. People say, well, where did God come from? He always existed. He doesn't have a beginning. So, beginningless. Otherwise, it would require a cause, and that cause would need a cause, and so on, leading to what we call infinite regress, which is a non-logical concept. That, well, something created the Bible, and what created the Bible? Something created that, and then something created that thing that created the thing that created the Bible. And you see, you can't just go back indefinitely, infinitely, forever, because you never have a starting point to come forward to get to this Bible existing. Do you see that? If you never get to the starting point where there's an uncaused cause, you can't arrive at the present moment. That's the problem. It's illogical. It must be changeless. Because mutability pertains to finite things. Must be immaterial. The uncaused cause must be immaterial because matter did not exist prior to the creation of the event, or to the creation event. Must be timeless. Time also did not exist prior to the creation event. Spaceless, of course. Time, space, matter, right? None of those existed until the creation. So it must be timeless, spaceless, immaterial, changeless, beginningless, personal, and powerful. Amazingly powerful. The ability to create what we call ex nihilo, out of nothing, causing something to exist that doesn't exist and isn't made up of parts of other things that already existed. Ex nihilo, ex out, nihilo, nothing, out of nothing. So it must have enough power to create ex nihilo, which requires, of course, a self-sufficient and self-existent power, a power that doesn't rely upon anything. If you remember our very first discussion on the attributes and the nature and the ontology of God, you can see in this uncaused causes required attributes and ontology all of the things I just listed, and probably you could come up with another 20 or 30 on your own. The farther you go into that argument, the closer you get to the God of the Bible, right? Because the God of the Bible is the only possible explanation for the actual creation event. All right, everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. The universe has a cause. The cause of the universe must itself be uncaused. Therefore, an uncaused cause of the universe exists. And then if you examine the attributes that the uncaused cause would have to possess, those attributes are all of those I listed and many others, all of which point to the God of the Bible. You can sit down with somebody and surely make that argument, if you came to the first session. Okay, are we good with that one? One more? Yeah, we got time. This one's pretty short. This is C.S. Lewis's moral argument. This is a brilliant argument. It wasn't his, really, but he refined it, or has his version of it, I should say. It answers the question, why do humans have a universal sense of morality? Murder and lying, for instance, seem to be universally immoral. These things are immoral in all societies. Right? Try to take another man's wife, that's wrong. Everybody agrees. Try to kill somebody for no reason or for selfish reasons, that's wrong. Lying is wrong. Theft is wrong, and so on. These are common things in humans. Humans seem to know these things innately. Have you ever read Mere Christianity? This is where I first got exposed to this article as a new believer. With C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity, he makes the argument this way. He says, suppose you're standing in line and a person cuts the queue, right? The line. In England, they call it the queue. Standing in line is queuing. So suppose somebody cuts in line and you point out, hey, that's wrong. You shouldn't do that. The person will do one of only a couple of things. Either deny that he or she actually cut in line, like, well, I was here before and I went to get a drink and I came back and this is my spot, right? Or at Luby's, it's my wife's been saving my spot, right? Which is the other option. Yeah, it's wrong, but in this particular instance, because of these particular circumstances, it's okay. But in neither of those responses do you hear anyone say, cutting in line, there's nothing wrong with that. What are you talking about? Whoever said that was wrong. We know it's wrong, right? Nobody has to teach us that that's wrong. We automatically know it's wrong. And that's the argument that C.S. Lewis begins to make when he's making this argument, this moral argument for the existence of God. It is from modern times. It was first produced for you philosophy guys and gals out there by Immanuel Kant, who was an agnostic, incidentally. But he made this argument in his work, Critique of Pure Reason. It was published in 1781, moral arguments from there, as far as we know. Lewis's version came about in the 1950s or so, 40s or 50s, whenever he wrote Mere Christianity. He argued that people have a general agreement on what is morally right or wrong. When people are caught transgressing a moral law, like cutting in line, as I explained, they do not deny the existence of the law, but rather make excuses as to why their transgression of it is acceptable in the present circumstance. So the absence of an objective, universal, and absolute moral law makes moral arguments baseless, no matter which side a person is on, and moral judgment's meaningless. So in other words, you can't really say, well, you know, you can't slap me in the face because it's wrong. Chris Rock couldn't say anything to the Fresh Prince for slapping him on stage because if there's no universal morality, then everybody has their own morality and no one can argue against another's. You see the problem? Yeah, if there's no universal moral law, then there's no universal moral law. And everybody can have their own morality, and but you can't make any arguments. You can't appeal to the moral law that everyone knows about if there isn't one. That's the problem. So, the argument. Just as we made in the intelligent design argument, evidence of design in the universe implies a designer. Here we go, same concept. So in the moral argument, evidence of human knowledge of a moral law that transcends humanity implies a lawgiver, right? It's outside of us. It's from somewhere else. And we all know about it. Right? If I'm the only one that knew about it, it could reside within me. But if we all know about it, it must come from somewhere else, outside of us. So this lawgiver must be prescriptive of and concerned with human behavior. Prescriptive meaning prescribing, saying what human behavior ought. Remember the ought thing the other day? What human behavior ought to be. Prescriptive, prescribing, like prescribing medicines. This lawgiver must be prescriptive of and concerned with human behavior and thus personal. Again, impersonal things don't create. Impersonal things aren't concerned with the morality of things it creates, right? So it must be personal. In order for this lawgiver to prescribe what is morally right, the lawgiver itself must be good. If the lawgiver is evil, what kind of laws are you going to get? At the very best, you're going to get laws that don't make any sense. At worst, you're going to get laws that, you know, bear signs of evil from their lawgiver. So thus, there must be a good, personal, moral lawgiver, and he is God, of course, and this is a summary of the argument's main points. Here we go. One, a human experience of morality is observed. We're going to start with the observation this time. God is the best explanation for this moral experience. Therefore, God exists. Now, the person who subscribes to Darwinian evolutionary theory, who's up on his or her reading, might argue to you that, yeah, well, morality evolved among human beings as a device for self-preservation. So they're basically saying that software was designed for the brain by an evolutionary process. And that breaks down on so many fronts, we don't even have anywhere near the time to address that idea. But just be ready for that one if it comes at you. You may have to take on evolutionary theory at that point. But that's the argument. A human experience of morality is observed. I think everybody agrees with that. And then God is the best explanation for this moral experience. We go straight to a conclusion, and then we go to a second conclusion. Therefore, God exists. There is morality. You can see it. God is the best explanation for this moral experience, and therefore, God exists. Now, one last point on this, and then I think we'll go to questions. I want to talk about the combined weight. So maybe you say, well, Noel, I'm not sure I like this one. Maybe that other one sounds better to me. I think I could argue this one better and so on. But what if you are able to learn all three arguments and make those to a person? Now you've got combined weight. And this is a major issue in apologetics, is the more arguments, logical arguments that we can make, the weight of the total, the sum total of those arguments at some point becomes overwhelming. Now, Dustin, not Pastor Dustin, cousin of mine, came to live with Steffi and I a few years ago. Well, 2008, Noah, something like that, yeah. And we were sitting at the dinner table one night. He hadn't been with us a couple of weeks. And I made the pronouncement that evolutionary theory is false. And Dustin dropped his fork on his plate, and he looked at me like I'd lost my mind. Now, he's a recent college graduate, by the way. He went to Ooey Pooey. That's Indiana University, Purdue University at Fort Wayne. He dropped his fork. He looked at me, and he said, "Oh, what about Darwin's finches?" I said, "I don't have to defend Darwin's finches. There are no transitional life forms in the fossil record." He said, "I've never heard that." I said, "Well, you went to a secular school. You know, if you took anthropology or any of those other things, then that's what you were taught. But there are a lot of problems with evolution." Dustin, that night, did not finish his supper. He left the table and went to his room where all of his school books were. And Dustin stayed up half the night going through his notes from his classes and going through his school books, and he couldn't find any refutation of the claim I had made. In fact, for the first time in his life, he began to question the whole idea of evolutionary theory. It wasn't a few months later, Dustin became a radically born-again Christian. Today, he has a Christian wife. Two of his children are saved. The other one's just a little baby. She's about three. He serves in his church. He's a deacon. He and Allie. Allie runs the worship ministry in their church out in Portland, Oregon. And I remember the night Allie got saved, because after Dustin got saved, the next thing he wanted to do was call his girlfriend Allie up in Indiana, who he wanted to marry, and he wanted her to be saved. And he shared the gospel with her, and then he comes running down the hall to me. I'm in the game room. And he says, "Noah, you got to come talk to me quick. I got Allie on the phone, and I think she's there. I think she's ready." "Ready what? What's going on? She's at the airport?" No, "I think she's ready to be saved." "Okay." I go down. I get Allie on the phone. I say, "Hey, Allie, what's going on?" She goes, "I can't believe what's happening to me." I said, "Well, tell me about it." She'd already been converted by the time I got to the phone. Dustin just didn't know that he needed to somehow close the sale in his mind. He thought he needed to do that. You don't close the sale. God does the work. He just didn't recognize that she had made. She said, "You know, I've never heard the gospel. I've been in church, Presbyterian church, my whole life in Bluffton, Indiana. Never understood the gospel, ever." You know, in her mid-20s. These things can be tools to bring people to Christ. I encourage you to learn these arguments. They're not very hard, and to employ them in your daily life, the combined weight of which can be overwhelming and to a tipping point where a person's obstacles to faith have been removed and the Spirit can work. It's in the notes for you, and I'll just tell you it's in the notes. I'm not going to review it, but I have there's another major argument out there called the ontological argument. It's a rather confusing argument. Oh gosh. It came around. Anselm, one of our early church fathers, we call one of the patristics, came up with the argument. He wanted to come up with something that would be utterly irrefutable. And of course, it's so confusing and difficult to follow. I encourage you not to ever try to use it. It's for academic circles only, and there's a lot of disagreement. I've been in the camp of you can't really make the argument. It doesn't stand up. It doesn't stand to reason. But it's in the notes. If you care to look at that, you'll be able to get those off online, and you can run through that. All right. Questions? And we only have 5 minutes before you have to pick up kids if you have kids, but I'll stay as long as you like.
I was just going to say, on the intelligent design, you talked about, you know, the designer and things like that. But, yep. You know, I always pictured it as, okay, so here's all the pieces to the watch. You know, somebody designed them, but somebody also had to put them together.
Indeed.
But the time and whatever is not going to put together that watch, even if all the pieces are sitting on the
exactly. Head. So you have to create the pieces, and you have to assemble the pieces.
Right. So it's not just.
And you have to create the material that the pieces are made out of nothing.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it gets really bad. And yet a universe exists with all these systems, right? I mean, if with a relaxed mind to look at these concepts, I mean, you have to lie to yourself, I think, to come away from these arguments and go, "Oh, that's poppycock. That's nonsense. Preposterous." But thank you, Phil. Yeah, that's very true. Oh, don't take his mic.
But I was actually a while back looking at Paley Bainer just to remember how to spell his name because I was looking at something else. But when you go to Google or Facebook, they just automatically say, okay, this is a theory that was, you know, in the 1800s. And of course, it's now been refuted. Now, they don't give any.
Which argument?
Why it's refuted.
Which argument is that?
Well, just the Paley's theology.
Oh, Paley's watchmaker argument?
Yes.
Okay, the teleological argument.
Right.
Yeah, the design argument. Okay. So somebody says it's been refuted, right, but they offer no support.
If you look up William Paley, it just says, oh, he was a guy that had this theory, the design theory. And, of course, now science says, no, they don't say science, they say research. They never say what research.
Yeah.
They do whatever, but if you look up on Google, it just says, oh, it's been refuted.
Yeah, and remember what we just said. If a premise isn't true, we can't just accept it. So if somebody says, well, that's been refuted, really? Can you demonstrate that? Because until I'm agreeing with you that that premise is true and that observation is true, I'm not even at a point where I can logically deduce a conclusion, you see. So in that scenario that Phil's bringing up, you guys, all of us, me too, be careful that we don't get sucked into or we don't break down in front of those claims. You know, if they're not true, if they're not provable, then they're not a premise for an argument.
That's what the fact checkers
are.
Sir?
No, it was on the internet. So.
Right, yeah. Well, everything on the internet is true. Yeah. Who's checking the fact checkers? That's what I want to know. I mean, used to be if it was on TV, right? Before that, if it was in the newspaper.
So I forget the end goal, but your life source argument. And I guess most times wondering, are philosophers using scientific explanation the way they're not intended to be used, right?
Can you hold a little closer? I'm sorry, I'm just not even hearing.
I'm wondering if philosophers are using scientific explanations in ways they're not meant to be used, right? So you use the life source argument, or you brought the issue of light slowing down, but I forget the end.
Oh, speed of light, yeah.
Yeah, speed of light. All right, so you actually can't measure the speed of light, right? So you have to measure, you have to guess at it, right? Because you got to have a device faster than the speed of light to measure the speed of light. So you measure the rebound. And so if all you can do is estimate it, how much credibility or weight am I willing to give to an argument when you actually can't even be sufficiently measure this one, right?
I don't know. I think that's probably just a conclusion you got to make on your own. Talk about the internet. I mean, you know, you can get 48.2 billion responses on the measurement of the speed of light in 0.2 seconds. You know, it's in every book of introduction to physics out there. But, you know, if you reject it, go to another argument. You know, if you're not comfortable with that one, make a different one. Like I said, you know, the weight of the arguments, I think, is more valuable than if you don't care for any one particular argument or how it's formulated. And I didn't make an argument based on the speed of light. I only introduced the notion that the age of the universe, which is measured by what's called redshift, how fast light has traveled from distant planets and galaxies to Earth, is a measurement for this 13.8 billion years that science has thrown at us. But that wasn't that was not a foundation or an observation or a conclusion in any of the arguments that I made.
Right. That's why I was trying to get the original of my statement. I said I'm worried that philosophers use scientific items in a way that they're unintended.
I think that's okay as long as they work. I mean, if they work, I don't care if they're intended to be used that way or not, really.
They don't work if you use that outside of the mean. So even like on your argument for the entropy, right? And so in the mechanical theory, you would never see a definition of entropy the way that philosophers are using, right? That things are going from disorder.
Well, I think I understand your point, but I would respond with this, Julian, and you're making a good point. I think it's a good point, but entropy is not exclusive to science. There's theological entropy. There's philosophical entropy. Entropy is just a word, and it's a word that has a general concept behind it. And but that concept can be used in any number of disciplines.
Right.
It's not exclusive to physics.
Okay, and so that's the part where philosophy is an issue. You're trying to
tag on scientific terms.
Yeah, okay. You're trying to tag on scientific terms to make it seem like the arguments are more scientific than what they are. If you have entropy, which is a scientific term, you're saying, oh, well, there are other ways to use it. Now you're distorting it. You're trying to tag on to science like you're more scientific because some of these items that have been presented, they're not repeatable, they're not observable, they don't fit our scientific method. And you're tagging, some of the arguments are tagging on science,
Yeah, I, with love and gentleness, would absolutely reject what you just said. And the basis for the rejection would be this. I'm not trying to tag on to science to make my argument seem scientific. I am using science and things that occur in science as a parallel. I could go the other way and make arguments for scientific laws of physics, for example, from philosophy and theology and apologetics. I'm not trying to make my arguments sound scientific. I am using those as parallels in a, as a form of argumentation. But again, when you look at my observations and conclusions, they don't do any of that. I'm just introducing additional information to help people see how these arguments can stand up. But I appreciate your remark. I appreciate your remark.
Yeah, he's not accusing you. He's saying that you said your son do that.
Well, but I would be one of those. I'm making these arguments and I'm introducing those concepts. I just don't agree that, and we can agree to disagree. I respect your view. But I don't agree that I'm trying to make something sound more scientific than it is. Those were your words. Simply by bringing a reality of science into the discussion.
It is fascinating.
Got to get kids.
So you have to, if you have children, you have to go get them. It's 8:03, so
all right.
Please get them quickly.
But thank you. I appreciate it. All right. Any others? Quentin.
It's not really a question or necessarily a comment. Well, actually, it is kind of a question. Have you heard of Alvin Plantinga?
Oh, yeah. He was a professor of intelligent design at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, where I graduated.
Cool.
Yeah, I know Alvin. In fact, he's in the notes. I didn't get to him, but he's in the notes.
Okay, because I was going to say, because I like in his book, God, Freedom, and Evil, where he basically lays out a really good argument for each of the arguments and then goes through and trashes them all. And then it basically comes down to the point at the very end. It's like it's all a matter of faith. It is reasonable to have religious belief. It is reasonable to have these things, but you don't have to have these arguments to do it.
I just really. Yeah, like, I mean, I was a born again believer before I ever heard anything about apologetics. Yeah. You know, it isn't necessary, but it's a great tool and it's a great discipline. Alvin Plantinga. I struggled 2 semesters trying to pronounce his last name. I had to write a paper on him.
Did you say he was your professor?
I said he was a professor of intelligent design at Southwestern.
How are we supposed to pronounce his name? His last name?
Plantinga. Like planting a at the end. So like planting a church, planting a Alvin. All right, other questions? Chapel.
So like, you explained basically how a lot of times, like, out of black beliefs, like modern scientists, they like to, they like attributed a lot of like contrary beliefs to the uniqueness of the universe, the uniqueness of the universe to like creating multiverses and stuff like that, like the existence of multiverses.
Yeah.
And I would even extend that to like life, like human life in itself, the uniqueness of that, because as recent times, like the government has talked about how they try to create like special languages and to reach out to civilization, as if to imply that extraterrestrial life might exist. So do you think this might also be like out of an attempt to disprove the uniqueness of life? And if so,
yes, I think I know where you're going. Yeah.
So because you said you aren't really a believer, like of aliens, so how can we refute arguments like that?
Well, about whether or not there's life on other planets?
Yes.
Well, I think, first of all, our faith doesn't stand or fall on that issue. First. Second, I don't think we need to defend or argue against whether or not there is life on other planets, whether it's, you know, similar to human life or intelligent or not, or, you know, or just base carbon life forms, you know, amoeba, things of that nature. But even though our faith doesn't rest on that and we're not compelled to defend the view, I would ask this question. Because I don't really care if there is or if there isn't. It doesn't refute the Bible, whether or not there's life on other planets. There's no refutation of Scripture. But I would ask the question, if there is intelligent life forms on other planets, do those intelligent life forms have a knowledge of morality? And if so, do they sin? And if they sin, what is the method of their redemption? That'd be my question. You got aliens running around out there killing people with fangs and dripping stuff and all that from the movies. You know, if that really exists, you know, where is their redemption coming from?
Sorry. And like that brings up a follow-up question that I'm about to ask. Why is it that you think the existence of like life won't refute our belief?
I can't hear you. A little louder.
So why is it that the existence of extraterrestrial life won't refute our beliefs, like Christianity?
There's no demonstration of that. I mean, just because something may exist, there may be a life form somewhere else. I mean, how would that undermine Scripture or the gospel? It doesn't. That's what we call a red herring argument on that list of 30 I'm giving you in the notes in the appendix. That's a red herring. That's like a statement that purports to be a sound, valid argument that is neither. It's just a statement. It's a claim. Well, there's life on other planets, so the Bible's not true. Well, but you have to demonstrate that, right? You have to have a premise and an observation and a logical conclusion. You can't just jump to a conclusion. Well, that refutes. That has to be demonstrated. There's no demonstration for that. Everybody follow that? Just because there may be discovered life on other planets is no refutation of Scripture. That would not in any way, there's no way to conclude from that, oh, well, Scripture is wrong. There's all kinds of information and knowledge that's not in the Bible. That may also be something that's true but not in the Bible. Yes, Tony?
Well, I have two things. One on that is, I agree with you. I mean, there's nothing in the Bible. God does not tell us everything.
Right.
So if he wanted to create other things someplace else, he could.
Sure.
And he doesn't need to tell us about it. So it doesn't, yeah, like you say, it doesn't refute our faith in God.
Yeah.
I mean, he could do whatever he wants together.
Sure.
But the other thing I wanted to say was, you know, I used to teach speech in college.
Yeah.
And of course, when you teach speech, one of the things is to teach students how to do persuasive speeches.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember having in one of my classes, there was a couple of guys that were Christian, and of course a bunch of them weren't. But what they chose to do a persuasive speech on was to persuade people of the creativity, you know, of the Genesis. And the thing was, is that they, you know, had several weeks to prepare this, and when they came back to do the speech, what they said was they had talked to their, I guess it's not a pastor, they were Baptist, whatever ministers are there, and he told them that there is, quote, no reasoning behind it, you just have to believe it. Faith. And I was very disappointed. I didn't say anything.
No reasoning behind the creation?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's just, unfortunately, an uninformed pastor. Yeah.
And I was very, I couldn't say anything to them too much, but I was very disappointed because I was thinking, oh, yeah, somebody's going to give some reasoning also, like you just did,
mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
About it. And I guess I'm just saying it would have been wonderful
These are subjects, Tony, that are so rarely discussed in churches today. I mean, if I could just say this, that the Christian church in America is grossly uneducated in these things. I mean, you can't hardly find a Christian who's actually led somebody to Christ. I mean, that's hard to find. You line up 100 Christians, you might not find a single one in the group. I know people who have been believers for 80 years, 70 years, never led a single person to Christ because they don't feel adequate, because they don't feel like they know, you know, what to do.
And that just hurt because these were young.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
College Christian men were ready to fight for it, and they went to their pastor or their minister or whoever.
And got nothing.
And they got nothing.
Yeah. It's a bummer.
That hurt.
That's a bummer. Thank you for that thought. Hey, Matt. You got a question, Noah?
I have a question. I wanted to look something up, and I found it. If you look up entropy, there's three definitions. There's a definition for physics, there's a general definition, and there's a fused definition. The second definition is lack of order or predictability, gradual decline into disorder. There's also physics,
Sure. Yeah, and you can Google theological entropy, and you'll get papers on that. Philosophical entropy, because entropy again, it's just a concept. It's a basic idea that things go from order to chaos. That's the idea, and it applies in lots of areas of life, including your closet. Thank you, Noah. All right. Is that it? Anybody else? Okay. Well, thank you all. Thank you for your grace and putting up with me. Two more. Trinitarianism and the historicity of Jesus. Let's pray and we'll be finished. Shall we? Heavenly Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for giving us the opportunity in a free country to gather, to assemble, and to discuss our faith and try to get better and understanding it, understanding you, and bringing others to you. And I pray, Lord, that that you would use these things in our lives to the best degree possible, that we might bring you honor and glory, that we might love you with all our hearts, souls, minds, and strengthen our neighbors as ourselves. In Christ's name, amen. Thanks, everybody. Noah, can you label this and turn this off again? I'm just afraid to do it because I don't want to.
All you have to do is hit stop and end it.
Yeah, that's the part I'm worried about, is putting the label on. I don't know where you go from there.
You hit stop.